Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. You're confident when it comes to your work and life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same confidence when it comes to refinancing your existing mortgage or buying a home. It lets you understand all the details so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. Go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Tech startups, tech giants, look like a blessing to job-hungry American cities, and in many, many ways they are. But they can also tear cities apart, says my guest today, Richard Florida, drive out the middle class, banish the people we need to keep a city running. It's time to deal with that, he says. This hour on Point, a new urban crisis, how the tech industry may be driving out the middle class and what to do about it. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Do you feel like you're living in a tale of two cities, priced out? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. The Google buses, the Apple buses flooded the streets of San Francisco a few years back. By 2013, 2014, those private buses sent in to pick up high-tech workers became a target of public chagrin. Praised when it began, but over time became a symbol of the economic divide in San Francisco. Opponent says it caused congestions, wasted money, sort of put in their face who was on top. Here's a YouTube clip of a protest against the Google buses in 2013. People want the tech industry. They want the jobs. But there is another side of this. Here's Amos Brown, director of the NAACP in San Francisco, talking with CNN Money last year, saying the tech community made San Francisco an unaffordable city for the middle class and people of color.
It's only for the affluent 2% and the dot-comers. The middle class, particularly the middle class in the black community, is non-existent. The tech people have lived in a silo. They've been in isolation. And they then come to share. They came to be greedy.
They came to be greedy. They're still coming. On Tuesday night, the San Jose City Council in California, right there at the edge of Silicon Valley, agreed to negotiate a sale of 250 acres of city-owned land to Google. The tech giant wants the land to build a new campus between 6 and 8 million square feet for offices and worker housing. Here's Kim Wallace, City's Economic Development Director, calling it a once-in-a-century opportunity, but community members and housing advocates voiced their concerns as well. Here was local resident Greg Miller in a video by KBCW.
I'm especially concerned that this project will negatively impact the already critical housing shortage. We should ensure that this project does not displace low-income communities.
Well, we'll see, but it's a big, big, ambitious project, and lots of cities looking at how to entice, but then also live with high-tech industry, high-tech startups. Richard Florida is looking at all this, and this is really interesting. He's kind of he wrote the book, The Rise of the Creative Class. We talked years ago about what was coming for cities and how big it would be. Now, he's written a new book called The New Urban Crisis. He teaches business and creativity at the University of Toronto, joins us right by Skype right now from Toronto. Richard Florida, welcome back to On Point.
Oh, it's great to be back with you. Thanks for having me, Tom.
So we associate you, your very name, your brand, with celebrating the urban experience, the creative class. I guess that certainly includes tech startups. Now we're reading here in a Technology Review, headline from you, the unaffordable urban paradise. Tech startups helped turn a handful of metro areas into megastars. Now they're tearing those cities apart. So what's going on? Is this manna from heaven or is this a plague?
Well, you know, that's why I took the past 7 years to write this book, The New Urban Crisis. And Tech Review, that great magazine, was so kind to not only excerpt the book, but really push me to write a broader piece on why these tech companies are both rebuilding our cities and, as you said, tearing them apart. Look, I think in all honesty, I underpredicted the extent of this urban revival prompted by, you know, young people and artistic people and designers moving back to great cities like San Francisco and New York and Boston and Philadelphia. I would have never imagined, you know, my original research back in the 80s was on high-tech companies, and those high-tech companies all were in somebody calls them a suburban Nerdistan, you know, this office park out near an off-ramp. There were no high-tech companies in the urban center. The nerdy engineers wanted to live in the suburbs and drive their fast performance cars, you know, to their corporate campus offices.
It was Silicon Valley in California. It was Route 128 outside Boston.
Yes.
This was
Boston,
not urban
suburbs.
Centers.
Sure. Seattle, where Microsoft is. We could go on and on and on about this. But, you know, over the past decade and a half, it's not just the creative class and artists and musicians and young people that came back to cities. Tech companies came pouring in. And when we had to, you actually have to go buy the data. It's expensive, but we had to cut and slice the data. But we were the first people to really look at this. More than half of all those venture-backed startups, it was daunting to me. More than half were in the urban core. They were in urban neighborhoods in downtown, as he was saying, in downtown San Francisco, near the south of Market, near the Mission, old burned out warehouse districts where you could find few companies and were low income housing. They were in lower Manhattan, you know, in Chelsea and Tribeca and Soho around NYU.
Yep.
What's so interesting, folks, the Silicon Valley, that the corporate complexes are now third in the country in venture capital funding. Number one is San Francisco, which collects over $20 billion a year for companies like Twitter and Uber and their new versions of upstarts.
Three times what's going into Silicon Valley, you remind us right now, last year anyway.
Yeah, number two is New York City with $9 billion, and number three is the classic Silicon Valley. So these tech companies have come roaring in because the younger people, the talented people, many are single, many are not coupled, many want a more exciting life, and they want to live in these places. So it's created a comeback, but it's also brought the crisis, you know, of the very success of these places, what I like to call the new urban crisis. Not a crisis of urban failure so much as a crisis of too much success, too much revival, which is kind of ripping these places apart.
I mean, Richard Florida, we've got listeners writing in already. A listener says, the age of suburbia is coming to a close. Money and jobs are concentrating back into the cities again. Okay, there's an ebb and flow. Maybe that was inevitable. The automobile sent us out into the suburbs, and now we're talking maybe about a post-automobile world at some point. But this has got real growing pains attached to it. You describe a kind of a driving out of the middle class or a hollowing out, and you lay it right at the feet of tech startups. Is that fair?
Well, you know, I think tech companies have to buck up. I'm not sure they're entirely to blame. And on this, the research is pretty good. For one, tech companies have had an effect on rising housing values. There's a good, not only my own research, but other research shows when the tech companies come in and you look at this controlling for other factors and so on and so forth, in New York, San Francisco, and across the board, they are associated with rising prices. Hard to say if they're really associated with gaping inequality. There are a variety of studies of this. Some say, yes, they have increased wage inequality. Some say, no, they haven't increased income inequality. But I think the bigger point is whether they're directly or indirectly at fault, they are to blame. You know, when Google wants those 250 acres in San Jose, Amazon, you know, one of the largest companies in the world, is now building a whole nother corporate campus in downtown San Francisco. Mm-hmm. When Twitter, you know, comes in and takes over Blocks, when Google takes over the old Port Authority building in New York, they become a target. And as you mentioned, with the attack on the shuttle buses, people are saying you got to buck up. And that's why I wrote the piece in Tech Review. I mean, most importantly, I thought it's time to, you know, put these people on the carpet. These are the richest, the most highly valued companies in the world. Apple, Amazon, Google, Facebook, and Microsoft. They're all building more. They all want their workers to live in better environments, either urban centers or what you were saying in the Silicon Valley, a suburb that looks more and feels more like an urban center. Mm-hmm. They've got to buck up and try to be part of the solution, not just the big part of the problem.
I mean, at one time, even now, people wouldn't say this is a problem. They just call it development. But you call it winner-take-all urbanism. Huh. What do you mean by that?
You know, it was a big wake-up call for me. You know, for years and years and years, I was a big cheerleader for the urban revival.
Oh, we know.
You know, I lived in Pittsburgh. You know, we wanted those tech companies. I think I couldn't believe it would happen, to be honest. As a kid from Newark, growing up in Newark, seeing my city devastated, witnessing the race riots, the trickle of the urban revival I wrote about in the late 90s and early 2000s, it really booms. You know, now we have the data. From 2000 to now is when this thing goes full bore. Young people come back. Baby boomers come back. Creatives come back. Professionals come back. You know, They want shorter commutes. They want better cities. Now, of course, cities got safer. We had the great crime decline, not everywhere, but in New York and San Francisco. All these factors produced a boom that no one would have predicted, and I don't think we were ready for it. And the big fact for me was, you mentioned it in your preview. Mm. Where is inequality the worst? Our largest, our densest, our most high-tech, our most creative cities. Where is economic segregation the worst? Our largest, our densest, our most innovative, our most knowledge-based cities. Where has our middle class declined the most? In the same exact places. So all of these things that have acted to spur the urban revival, that have made our cities stronger, that have helped America become more innovative, that same clustering of people and talent and tech companies that pushes forward innovation has also carved these deep and vexing divides in our society. I don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. I think we've got to move from this, what I call the winner-take-all urbanism, when a few cities and a few companies and an advantage class gets most of the benefits, to what I call an urbanism for all, where many, many, many more neighborhoods, many more people, many more class groups can share in the benefits of urban revival.
I mean, you say it's tearing cities apart, but I suppose the people within the tech bubble, they don't see that. You know, they've got their booming companies. They've got their plenty of coffee shops and cappuccinos. They've got, pedicures at the ready, and they're happy.
You know, I'm going to address the mayors on this later this week, the U.S. mayors. I'm going down to their conference, and we're going to talk about this. I mean, look at how clueless Uber was. In many ways, a company that revolutionized how you hail a ride. And, you know, for a while, people loved it. And then when they saw the way they, you know, I was with my Uber driver the other day. He was vocally complaining to me about how crappy Uber treats its drivers. Many more people now who have choice are moving to other ride-hailing services, going back to cabs. You know, Airbnb, the company that also disrupted the sharing of homes, many cities are now saying, hey, I've had enough. I think, you know, take that with the Google bus protest in Silicon Valley. People are saying enough's enough. You are the most valuable companies in the world. You are the richest people in the world, Bill Gates and Jeff Bezos.
Yep.
Come on, give back. And, you know,
Richard Florida, hold the thought right there. I promise we'll come to it. Richard Florida's new book is The New Urban Crisis. He's warning that high tech can tear cities apart even as it pumps them up. Behind us right here, Google Bus Song by Seymour Results and Arlington Worthmore about the whole Google Bus controversy in San Francisco. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
I'm on that Google Bus. I'm on that Google Bus. I'm on that Google, that Google, that Google, Google Bus. I'm on that Google Bus. I'm on that Google Bus. I'm on that Google, that Google, that Google, Google Bus.
I'm on that Google Bus, eating sushi at the drive-thru. Super happy that I didn't take that job at Yahoo. I'm on that Google Bus.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. With Rocket Mortgage, you can apply simply and understand fully so you can mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS ConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about how tech startups, everybody's golden goose, can also make cities unlivable for everybody not in the game. With Richard Florida, early champion of the creative class, turbocharging urban environments here was the idea then and now, but what about the consequences? He's got a piece out in the last couple of days in Technology Review. The headline is The Unaffordable Urban Paradise. Tech startups, it says, help turn a handful of metro areas into megastars. Now they're tearing those cities apart. You can join us this hour. Have you experienced an urban tech boom? The excitement, the money, the side effects? Have you been gentrified, tech-moneyed, out of your own city or town? Or are you living the dream, watching tired neighborhoods spring to life, living in the high-rise, downing the free cappuccinos? Little tape here. This is Chirag Bhakta, an affordable housing advocate in the Mission Housing Development Corporation in San Francisco. He grew up there, the Tenderloin neighborhood. Wired put out this video this past February, him saying a lot has changed since the city started offering big tech companies tax breaks 5 years ago.
The Tenderloin is perhaps the only neighborhood left in San Francisco for low-income working class people to find a home. So right now, the Tenderloin is going through the first steps of gentrification and turning into a neighborhood of haves and have-nots.
Not a new issue. Back in 2015, HBO put out the documentary San Francisco 2.0, looked at how the tech boom had affected historically progressive city there. Here's Siani Hill, a lifelong resident of Hunters Point, evicted from her home.
All these companies coming in and taking over our area, it's a little difficult because we have nowhere to go. Where do we go? Where do we stand as a people in our own neighborhood where we're getting pushed out of because of these large billion-dollar tech companies?
Richard Florida is joining us from Toronto today. His latest book is The New Urban Crisis, How Our Cities Are Increasing Inequality, Deepening Segregation, and Failing the Middle Class, and What We Can Do About It. With us there from Toronto, Richard Florida, stand by. Big news this week has been out of San Jose in California, right there on the rim of Silicon Valley. And the big deal that they are doing with Google, which wants to put a mega campus more or less in the middle of town there. Dev Davis joins us right now from San Jose, San Jose City Council member. She represents District 8, the location of Google's massive planned development. Dev Davis, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me. How are you doing, Tom?
Well, great. Describe the scale of what Google is contemplating for the heart of your city.
They're looking at building 6 to 8 million square feet of office, as well as some homes, and there will be commercial retail space as well on their campus, which is right next to our Diridon Station, which is going to be the Grand Central Station of the West. It currently has multiple commuter rails. It will also have our subway called BART station coming in, as well as high-speed rail.
250 acres. Is that all? What's there? What's getting pushed out, Dev?
A lot of what's there right now are surface parking lots.
Okay.
So it will be building on land that is underdeveloped. There is some industrial. There are some industrial tenants on some of the other privately owned land, and Google has purchased some of that land as well.
I mean, your city council voted 10-1 to welcome this in, to get in negotiation with Google. So I guess you want to bring it on. But here we've got Richard Florida, who's on the line with you from Toronto, big guru of urban development, and he's warning about big tech companies ultimately tearing cities apart with inequality, making them unaffordable for the middle class. Are those concerns there for, I mean, you're no stranger to technology. You're right there in Silicon Valley. But are these concerns for you, Councilwoman Davis?
These are concerns, but we do have to realize that we already have tens of thousands of Google workers already living in San Jose. So this is a potentially a way for them to be able to shorten their commute and to stay in San Jose instead of having to travel up to Mountain View and other places around the Bay Area.
Yeah. Richard Florida, you're there in Toronto. I'm sure you've been paying attention to what Google came out with this week with San Jose. What are your questions for Deb Davis, who's on the city council there, about the future of her city as this mega development likely comes in?
Well, first of all, I think Kim Wallace, who's the economic development director there, is fantastic. And just hearing Kim's involved gives me confidence that this can work out. And I think the councilor said something important. San Jose, which has not been a comeback city, you know, this isn't Palo Alto or San Francisco. Yeah. This is a community that's needed reinvestment. It's a good thing that it's going to get Google investment, and it's a good thing that it will get commercial and real estate development. But here's what I think, councilor and folks. Google needs to buck up. In New York, Bill de Blasio talks about inclusionary zoning and affordable housing. If you want to build a luxury tower, you've got to build affordable units. Let's go further with Google and Amazon. Let's talk about inclusionary prosperity that benefits everyone in San Jose or Seattle. You got to provide affordable housing, not just for Google workers, but for the people who work in Google's cafeteria and the people who make low-wage jobs. And you've got to pay them decently. You know how to make good jobs at Google. You make great jobs. You create an environment with childcare and daycare and cafeterias. Pay everyone a living wage. Give people from disadvantaged neighborhoods a go. And let's work to upgrade all the jobs. Let's lessen this divide between the high-paid techies and the low-paid service people who are working in food service and the caring professions. Be part of this community, not just a good corporate citizen, but be an urban steward. I think this is what's coming. I think the backlash is going to be worse than most people. We call them anchor institutions, high-tech companies, yep. big real estate developers, eds and meds. They've got to be part of the solution, not only of building innovative complexes, but of being an inclusive city for everybody.
Councilor Davis, they're in District 6 in San Jose. Are you confident that Google will do that rather than driving out the middle class and leaving nowhere for service workers and the whole support infrastructure of people, humans, to live?
Google has given us every indication that they want to work with us and work with our community and be part of the community. So it's important to know that what we passed on Tuesday called for transparent community engagement. And in fact, Google has already met with neighborhood leaders and started that process. And we're, of course, myself, as well as the other council member in District 3, Raul Perales, are facilitating that. And it's also important to note that Google has asked for and will be receiving no subsidies from the city of San Jose. So they'll be paying tens of millions of dollars in affordable housing impact fees.
So
that's good news.
Maybe 20,000 jobs would come in here to this part of San Jose. And we're talking about, 3,000 housing units? Is that sufficient to deal with the people that they'll need to back them up within their employment and surrounding them, Dev?
That's a great question. We have a housing crisis in all 9 counties of the Bay Area, and Google is not going to solve that with 3,000 housing units. But there are also 6,000 housing units already in the pipeline downtown, right near the soon-to-be Google campus. So there are other housing developments already in the works and also being talked about as a result of Google wanting to come in here.
Councilor Dev Davis of District 6 in San Jose, thank you very much for being with us. You are in the thick of it right now. We wish you good luck. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Richard, Florida, in Toronto, we have the mayor of San Jose, Sam Liccardo, saying Google is neither our savior nor our servant. Mm. We want Google to be our partner in helping to build a vibrant and inclusive downtown. So whether it's Google or a tech startup that's tiny compared to the giant Google, what are the steps that you're suggesting that tech players should be taking to be more proactive in terms of helping lessen inequality and displacement in our cities?
Well, I think you see the shift already occurring in that comment from the mayor and other mayors. Look, the 250 acres, lots of workers, biggest player in the community. You've got to be part of building our community, not just extracting. And, you know, I think it's changing. For years and years and years, high-tech companies saw themselves as extracting. They were great. We located there. Look what we did for you. But no more. Especially, you know, we can no longer, with Trump in office, depend on our federal government to do anything for cities. In fact, our federal government and many state legislatures, not California, but many others, are cutting off aid to the cities. We got to do it ourselves. And if Google wants a good city to work in, a diverse city, a kind city, a caring city, an inclusive city, it's got to buck up. So I think there's a couple things. It's not just about inclusionary zoning, which I mentioned before. Just trading some affordable housing units. I think it's got to be about full-bore inclusionary prosperity. On the one hand, building as much as 10, 20, maybe more, maybe 30% affordable housing, partly for your own workforce, those cafeteria workers and service workers who are commuting an hour or 2 hours away, yep. and partly for community residents. But also, these companies know how to make good jobs. They made them for the techies. You know, one thing I always talk about is we made manufacturing jobs good jobs during the Depression and the post-war era. We took low-wage, crappy work, and we gave people the right to unionize and organize, and we turned them into middle-class jobs. 65 million Americans work in low-wage service jobs. Many of them places like Google are serving Google workers. Those companies now have to upgrade those jobs and give them career paths. We've got to do all those things, and I think just as the counselor said in the mayor's comments, the pressure is mounting, and it's time to bring more pressure to bear because these companies have the resources to help us not only build their own great corporate complexes, but they want to be in great cities. They can help build great cities.
The golden goose, tech, can also come in and tear a city up. Richard, Florida, lays that right at their doorstep in a piece he's just put out in Technology Review, The Unaffordable Urban Paradise. His new book is The New Urban Crisis. He joins us from Toronto. People from around the country responding, Richard, Florida. Joseph, right here in Boston. Joseph, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I actually work for Wayfair in their corporate headquarters right in Copley.
It's the big online sales outfit for home products.
Yes.
Okay.
And I moved to Boston for this job, and I've really learned a lot about the history since I moved here. And what I did notice is that many of the problems that Boston faces in terms of housing and public transportation have been very long running and are a result of neglect. And I don't think that the startups and companies that have either started up here, moved here, are responsible for that. I think Boston should have been more proactive with that, because sometimes businesses will move and sometimes they'll start up and they'll become very big. And you have to make sure that you have a responsible housing policy so that the poor people and people who have grown up here don't completely get screwed over by it. But at the same time, I have noticed that I don't think that Wayfair is very inclusive, especially in our engineering department. I think that it could do more to hire more women and people of color and really help increase their wealth, especially among people who have grown up in Boston and are definitely ready to work for Wayfair.
Joseph, let us take it up with Richard Florida. I mean, claim A, not our fault. Cities didn't come to this with clean hands. They've got their own issues and problems that go back decades. Don't put it on us. Number two is interesting, you know, not just direct economic action, but inclusivity and high-tech firms maybe not being the first to jump out front on diverse employment.
Well, you know, I don't know that much about Wayfair, but, you know, Boston just gave General Electric a lot of money to move to their downtown area, an area that was booming.
The new Seaport District there.
General Electric is a very wealthy company. First, they shouldn't, as the councilor said with San Jose, they shouldn't be giving them a penny. If you want to locate here, that's great. In fact, if you want to take advantage of Boston and all the great amenities and great universities, you should be paying in, not just in taxes. You should be part of making our community more inclusive. MIT has just announced a major program to rebuild part of Kendall Square. Now, you know, universities like tech companies are great anchors and many times more important to the long run health of a community and to its revitalization. Stanford in the Silicon Valley, MIT for Boston and Cambridge. These universities have affordable housing programs for their professors. If you're going to go to Stanford, Stanford's going to help you buy a house and subsidize you.
Yeah.
If you're going to go teach at NYU, you're going to get an NYU apartment. I could go on and on. Well, let's think about how to build inclusive communities, not just a community for the advantaged. These universities employ a lot of service people. The other point I want to make that the caller is so eloquent on, I actually think the urban revival is more fragile than many people think. That, no, San Francisco's doing great, and, you know, parts of New York are doing good. But, you know, as federal cutbacks hit housing and affordable housing, as cutbacks begin to hit police programs and crime and also the programs of crime and violence reduction, youth employment, this urban revival we've come to take for granted. Our cities might, you know, there might be a backtracking on this. You could see crime rising in a place like Chicago. You could see Detroit, which has had reinvestment. The schools aren't great. So I think it's not only the tech companies are causing inequality. If they don't chip in with us, if the universities don't come to the table, my longer run fear is some of the mechanisms that generated the urban revival may start to unravel, just as the caller said, and all of these problems that were getting better in cities might not in every city, but in certain cities might reassert themselves. So I think for our long run health and well-being, our long run sense of an inclusionary society, but our long run economic competitiveness and innovativeness, we've got to take this issue of inclusionary cities and better cities, urbanism for all, much more seriously than we have been.
Let's jump across the country, go to Eric in San Francisco. Eric, thank you for calling. You're on the air with Richard, Florida.
Hey, Tom, how are you today?
Very well. What do you see?
Having the show on.
Sure.
It really hits home. I've lived out in San Francisco since 1982. I moved out from Massachusetts. And, you know, I've seen a definite change. It was more of a small town, small city feeling. Now that a lot of the high-tech companies have moved in, you know, the population has just boomed. The transportation systems are really crowded now. And worst of all, I hear from a lot of friends that there's an entitlement attitude amongst a lot of the high-tech folks that move into the city. And they've cornered people out of reasonable housing, reasonable rent, and reasonable house prices. They have just boomed. My wife and I were very fortunate. We bought a house in the early 90s, right when housing prices were coming back up again after a little recession. But, man, you just cannot afford a home now unless you make a lot of money.
But would the city be better off without that economic dynamism, Eric? I mean, I get the problems, but would you banish it?
I see what you're saying. I see what you're saying, because I blame part of it on the city's politicians, the board of supervisors, and the mayor's office. I think they let it get out of control. I think that they allowed the city to move too fast. Now, they may have seen this coming down the line. They may not have seen it coming down the line. I don't know. I worked in city government in the controller's office for some time. And sometimes, I don't know. That's a good question. I just don't know if they saw this coming or not. We needed the money, true. But now that the money is here, you see a real split. You got really rich people. You got really poor people. Folks like my wife and I, who have lived here for a long time, are getting fewer and fewer our income levels.
Yeah. Eric, we are loud and clear, and I appreciate your calling in from San Francisco. We'll pick it up with Richard, Florida, after a short break here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about how tech startups, everybody's golden goose, can also make cities unlivable for those not in the game, with Richard Florida, early champion of the creative class turbocharging urban environments. Now he's out with a new book called The New Urban Crisis. He's been writing in Technology Review that tech startups helped turn a handful of metro areas into megastars. Now, he writes, they're tearing those cities apart in many ways. Just last month, Amazon announced it would dedicate space in its newest Seattle headquarters for a family shelter housing homeless women and their families. Here's a little video released by Amazon on the day of the announcement. John Shetler, Amazon's vice president in charge of global real estate, hands a cardboard Amazon box to Marty Hartman, executive director of Mary's Place. He asks her to open the box, reads a letter that was inside.
Dear Marty, Amazon is excited to share some great news with you. Part of our next office. Really? Mm-hmm. Will also be dedicated to Mary's Place, a permanent home for Mary's Place. Welcome home, Marty.
Well, okay, that's good. That's good. But what about the big picture here? What about the overall effect? Richard Florida, here's a listener who says the concern about shredding the fabric is overblown. If you want to see shredded fabric, look at a city that can't attract new jobs and affluent residents.
I think that's absolutely right. I think that one of the things we have to worry about is the winner-take-all urbanism, where just a few cities and a few parts of cities attract the lion's share of the investment. And we know who they are: New York and San Francisco and Seattle and Boston and D.C. and a few others. But more importantly, in those winner-take-all cities, we have to make sure that tech companies and other anchor institutions pay their fair share. But also, you know, look at Pittsburgh, where I lived for nearly 20 years. It has a comeback story in its downtown core. Look at Detroit, where Dan Gilbert and other very wealthy people are rebuilding the urban center. Those cities, too, have divides. And I think across the board, you know, this isn't going to be taken care of by some big federal policy that city builders, local governments, universities, medical centers, tech companies, and real estate developers all have to be part of the solution. And we all have to move away from this kind of winner-take-all urbanism to a much more inclusive prosperity for everybody.
Solve it. Solve it right there and maybe locally. Richard Florida, stand by there in Toronto. Justin Steele joins us as well right now from Cambridge, Massachusetts, professor of law and urban planning at MIT. Justin Steele, thanks very much for joining us today.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
What do you think of the thesis? Yes, this brings jobs, and yes, this creates a lot of economic dynamism, but it can also tear cities apart, and tech companies, for one, themselves need to be centrally instrumental in helping respond to the problems created here. What do you say, Justin Steele?
I agree with that. I'm just a little skeptical about tech companies, how much they will be willing to do and how much they actually will do. I mean, we've seen some tech companies like Uber willfully breaking local laws in open conflict with cities, and it's not just Uber, there are others as well. And so I think we need other approaches to also hold tech companies accountable, hold cities accountable, and look at some of the larger reforms that we need to address income inequality.
Other approaches, you're not willing to depend on them to step up? Other approaches like what?
I think we need to demand that they step up, but I think that they alone can't do this. I mean, if we look at what's causing inequality, there's automation, changing returns to skill. There's also a consistent decline in the real minimum wage and decline in unions. And in the book, Richard Florida talks a lot about how manufacturing jobs decades ago provided a living wage, but doesn't talk that much about the role of unions in actually working with businesses and working with the state to create real living wages. And I think now we have a situation where many corporations are kind of trying to undermine any attempts by workers to organize, by tenants to organize, not working that closely with governments, trying to fight government. And so those are some of the things that I think are really contributing to this that cities can do, but that we also need at larger scales at the state level and at the federal level.
Richard Florida, I mean, yourself, you're looking at minimum wages here and saying that they ought to be tied to prevailing local median wages and make them 50% of local median wage. I mean, right now the federal minimum wage is $7.25 an hour, but if it was 50% of the prevailing local median wage, it would be more than double that in San Jose. It'd be $14 in San Francisco, $13 in Boston, New York, Seattle, you say. That's not something, is it, that tech firms are going to make happen? Justin Steele is skeptical that they're going to be willing to put their shoulder to the problems you're talking about, Richard, or that maybe they're the right agent to solve these problems.
Well, first of all, mayors and cities in many places where they're not preempted by red-leaning conservative state governments can make that happen. And we have to do that.
On minimum wage,
to lift the minimum wage. We have to geographically index it and make it 50 or 60% of the local median. I am a strong believer in the role of unions in bolstering manufacturing workers. I say it explicitly in my book. My dad and I talked about it at length. The Wagner Act was a key factor in giving workers the right to unionize and collectively bargain and unionize and raising the floor. But we need new mechanisms for collective organization, and we need new mechanisms to organize these 65 or 70 million service workers who, for the life of me, very few people in America are talking about. But here's the rub. Donald Trump really is the president. Both houses of Congress are controlled by Republicans. Look across our great country. It is a sea of red with tiny blue specks in Boston, Seattle, New York, and San Francisco. And in many cases, the state legislatures are dominated by people who are to the right of Donald Trump. The only hope we have in the short run is our cities. They don't have enough resources. They don't have enough revenue. So who can help them? The anchor institutions like MIT, like University of Toronto, like Stanford, these great hospital complexes, and who else? Tech companies and real estate developers who are making super profits over their urban locations. So none of this is a magic bullet. None of this is a silver bullet. But if folks like me and Justin and others speak up with a loud voice, we can put additional pressure that allows the folks in San Jose and the councilor and the mayor to get more. But there is no magic bullet. We are in a tough spot in America, probably our toughest spot in my life and maybe in my dad's life, too, where we have a very rightward turn in this country. Look, the one reason I'm optimistic, though, you know, San Francisco is not a gated suburb. Boston, Massachusetts is not a gated suburban Route 128. New York City, they are places where racial and ethnic and class diversity have flourished.
San Francisco is one of the whitest cities in the country. It's not got a physical gate, but the very industries you're talking.
But it's not a gated suburb. And the pressure from lower income people and other groups that are being displaced, as the videos that you played, suggest to me that they are the one place that these issues can be effectively contested. But I agree, there is no magic bullet. I wish that we had a different president. I wish we had a different politics in this country. But the only lever I think we can increasingly push on is to say that people who are benefiting from cities, particularly those big companies and big institutions, as well as local government creating those standards we need, everybody bucks up and moves us to more inclusive prosperity and away from the kind of exclusionary prosperity we have today.
Grapple organically and locally with these issues. Christopher in Baltimore. Thank you for calling, Christopher. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks so much for taking my call. It's an outstanding show. I'm a proud Baltimore native, and I lived for many years in the southeast Baltimore waterfront. I moved there when I started law school back in 1996, when it was still very much a working-class kind of hard scrabble, crab-eating, blue-collar neighborhood. And I got to tell you, I loved every bit of it. We had neighborhood stores. We had a lot of mom-and-pop shops.
Yep.
And then Safeway opened. And then the big-box stores started showing up. And all these little neighborhood institutions started folding up. And then the houses started getting rehabbed, and then before you know it, they became unaffordable, and there was nowhere to park. And so I witnessed a massive transformation in this wonderful historic community, which I no longer live in. I had to move to be closer to work. But I've always been a big fan of how cities can better plan for the type of development that can absorb a tech company in the first place. And I use Baltimore as a case study. One of the biggest problems, and I think it's true in Baltimore and also nearby Washington, D.C., is our public transit system, be it regional trains, buses, trolleys, name it, are atrocious. Baltimore really doesn't have anything close to even a real public transit system the way Boston, New York, or Washington, D.C. does. And I'm sure the condition of the D.C. Metro has been well publicized about the true impact on the local economy that this poorly run and managed system has. Baltimore had a proposed red line. Unfortunately, our governor decided it was a boondoggle.
But Christopher, let me ask you, I got the picture, but do you trust that, let's say you've got, I don't know, if you have tech companies coming into Baltimore, do you trust that they're going to step up and work hand in glove with the city and the community to tackle these issues, or are they just going to see it as an opportunity to come in and extract, as Richard Florida says?
Well, I think my experience in Baltimore has been much more the extraction than the cooperation, although Kevin Plank is a big exception with Under Armour. He's doing some amazing things working with the city, helping out local residents, impoverished folks, to bring them into work for his company, building a huge, massive new waterfront development. So I think it can work that way, but my experience is that it has not.
Christopher, I appreciate your call very much from Baltimore. Thank you very much. Let me get one more right here. Tim in Dennis, Massachusetts. Tim, you're on the air with Justin Steele and Richard Florida.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
You know, I love the optimism of having these diverging groups work together, but I just think it's unrealistic. I mean, these organizations have different profit motives and different incentives. And as a founder of a successful tech company, I just don't see how that sells. I'm not saying that we can't be driven by this altruism, but these are really issues for regulation and for government. And this is where we, as the people, have to push these issues up to. And while I appreciate, you know, we have our president and this is who it is, but these are where these issues need to be driven to. They need to be driven driven by our politicians, and we need to have faith in them and have faith that regulation can help society.
Tim, I appreciate your call. Justin Steele, is that your point, that you're just not willing to have that faith in tech companies to do this, that it's got to be we the people, as Dennis says, or as Tim says?
Yes, exactly. That's exactly my point. I think that we've had so many decades of attacks on government and undermining public institutions that are really important to our well-being, to equalizing access to opportunity. And I think we really do need to build the structures so that we can hold tech companies accountable if they don't do this, and other anchor institutions. I think the focus on anchor institutions is an excellent one and a very worthwhile one, but I think the question is, how do we make sure that they really follow through? And I think for that, we need public involvement, and we need strong local governments and strong states.
But who's the realist here? I mean, as you say, decades of attacks on government, and Richard Florida points out, well, look right now at state legislatures and look at Washington, D.C. Maybe, you know, it may not be the way people originally conceived it, but maybe that's just not going to work. And if you want to get it done, it's going to have to be organically working local governments with local business. Justin, what do you think?
Yes, I think that's true. I think it is important for local governments to work with local businesses. I just don't think that we can count on the businesses to do this all out of altruism. I think we need regulation. We need public pressure. We need local governments to play a role. So I think tech companies have a role to play, but we can't count on them to do this on their own.
Richard Florida, our caller Tim says, come on, they got a profit motive, not this general Commonwealth motive. Don't count on that.
So we Justin and Tim and I pretty much agree. Look, we have a couple of tools we can use. We can use community benefit agreements. We have to stop giving the money like we just did in Boston with GE. No more handouts. Stop it. Just stop it now. It's over. No, just say no. Second thing we have to do is make them pay their godforsaken fair share of taxes. Come on, no more. You guys are the richest companies on the planet. Third thing is, if you want to come here and take advantage of our great city and our great institutions, you're going to sign a community benefit agreement. And that means you're going to provide affordable housing for your workers, service workers, and for the community. You're going to employ local people, and you're going to create pathways for their betterment. You're going to do all the things you need to do to be part of building a real city, not a corporate campus gated complex. The second thing we need to do, and I think we have a moment here with the Paris Climate Accords. We have now hundreds of cities that have come together and said, we're going to work because our federal government is dysfunctional. We have to have a longer game. The inclusionary prosperity is a short game. The long game has to be we have to move power out of Washington and give it back to our cities, recognizing that we're a nation of differences, red and blue city and suburb. We've got to give cities more power and more tool to regulate, to create policy, and to really contribute and maintain the revenues that they're shipping off to Washington. So I think those are the things we have to do in the here and now, realistically, to make this work. I shudder to think, if we don't do this, what will happen to our cities if they're ripped apart and divided any further. And I shudder to think about what the end of the urban revival might look like. So,
but if you demand all that, Richard,
hands on deck.
Forgive me, but if you demand all that, maybe the companies just shrug and turn around and walk away, go back to the suburbs or some other city that's not as insistent.
Or maybe they move offshore. I think that's a big risk to the United States now in the era of Trumpism, that some of these companies just say, the hell with you. We have functional governments in places like, for one, Canada, which has publicly supported healthcare, which still has a safety net where people are treated like human beings, and we'll go there. But I don't think these companies can survive in corporate campuses. I really believe that they need the diversity and vibrancy and creativity of cities. So we've got them in a pickle. And the time to really engage them. And I agree with Justin. This isn't just like be nice citizens and be altruistic. Pin them down. You have some leverage in this, the mayors of San Francisco and San Jose, New York, Boston, and so on. Pin them down and make them buck up and do the things they need to do.
Justin, pin them down. You've got the leverage. You agree?
I agree. One thing I would add, if it's okay, is that I think also, as Richard was saying, you know, there's a yearning for this diversity in cities for these companies, but it's ironic that the tech industry is dominated by white men. And I think that that's another issue that, that needs to be addressed in terms of the racial inequality and the racial wealth gap and the gender wealth gap in cities, too.
Boy, the Rubik's Cube is spinning here these days. Who's going to do what? Who's going to take responsibility for what? Where we put our trust and our confidence and our pressure to build the kind of economy and society that we want to have. Richard Florida writes about it in his new book, The New Urban Crisis, and has written about it in Technology Review as well. Richard Florida, thank you very much for sharing your insights with us today.
Thanks for having me back, Tom. It's always a pleasure being with you.
Great having you. And Justin Steele, professor of law and urban planning at MIT. Really great to have you jump in here, Professor Steele. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom, for having me.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm at Tom Ashbrook, NPR, on Twitter. Thanks for joining us today. This is On Point.